Amen. All right, 2 Kings chapter 11 and 12 is where we're going to be today. 2 Kings chapters 11 and 12, a little bit of an overlap. We're doing a study of the kings of Israel and Judah. And last time we were all together like this, we looked at Athaliah, who was the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, very much like her mother, who killed all of her grandchildren and living children to seize power after the death of her son. And for about 6 or 7 years there, it was a very dark time in Judah. But kind of interwoven in the story there, chapter 11 of 2 Kings is primarily about Athaliah and her overthrow. But in the middle of chapter 11, beginning verse number 4, the seventh year Jehoiada sent and fetched the rulers over hundreds with the captains of the guard and brought them into the house of the Lord and made a covenant with them and took an oath of them in the house of the Lord and showed them the king's son. Okay, verse number 12 of chapter 11 says, he brought forth the king's son, put the crown upon him, and gave him the testimony. And they made him king and anointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, God save the king. And the rest of the chapter is primarily about, the overthrow of Athaliah and then the overthrow of the house of Baal. But in the middle of this story about Athaliah, you have the introduction of Joash, okay? When he was made king here, you see in chapter 12, verse number 1, in the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign. 40 years reigned he in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. So here in chapter 12, verse 1, he is called Jehoash. If you will hold a finger here and turn over to the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles, we're going to bounce back and forth a little bit. 2 Chronicles chapter 24 is the parallel passage here. We're going to bounce back and forth between these two if you want to put a marker or offer an envelope or something there to hold your place. 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 1, Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. Okay, so he's more familiar to us, I think, by the name Joash, but his name is Jehoash, right? There is another fellow with the same name. Stop me if you've heard this before. But there's another fellow of the same name who was king in Israel a little bit later. He's recorded in chapter 13 of 2 Kings. Okay, but both of them are referred to as Jehoash and Joash, kind of like Steve and Stephen or Matt and Matthew, a shorter or longer form of the same name. But this Joash that we're talking about today is the king of Judah in the south. So this is a different king than the king of Israel that's mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 13. I'm going to refer to him as Joash because that's how he's more familiar to us, I think, for those of you that have any familiarity at all. And if you don't have any familiarity with him, he's Joash. All right? So we see here he began to reign when he was 7 years old. Now, to me, that's just a completely foreign concept. I am old enough to remember the ridicule of Dan Quayle for being too young when he was running for vice president, and he was 35 years old, which were right around that minimum age of between 35 and 40. I cannot imagine a 7-year-old being king. Of course, someone with the mentality of a child and someone else really pulling the strings may or may not be that hard for Americans to imagine, but you'll just have to fill in those blanks yourself. But a 7-year-old was made king. This part just blows my mind. They put a crown on his head, they put the robe on him, and they had all the orchestra, the trumpets and all that declare, God save the king, to a 7-year-old. Now, do children have a hard time with a mentality that the earth revolves around them? Do you have to teach that to them? They have a hard time picking up on that? Not at all. okay? That we're born with that sin nature that kind of makes us assume that the world revolves around us, okay? So I have tried to, you know, put myself in that line of thinking and think, okay, you got a 7-year-old who is told, you're the king, you're in charge, okay? I mean, pick somebody under the age of 12 in our church or in your family, and just imagine if they were in charge as the king, how would things run? I mean, some of them act that way now, right? They have to be reminded on a regular basis that the world does not revolve around you, and this is how things operate in our family, and this is how things operate in the classroom or in the, you know, whatever the case may be. The 7-year-old was made king, all right? What was his lineage? He was the son of Ahaziah, which means Athaliah was his grandmother. So on dad's side, it was, you know, the house of David. On mom's side, it was the house of Ahab and Jezebel. Well, on his grandmother's side, you know, on from dad's family, his grandmother was Athaliah. So anyway, that was a little bit of his lineage. What do we know about his upbringing? Well, his parents died when he was an infant. I mean, you know that, but his dad was Ahaziah. That was one of the two kings that Jehu killed in the same week. Jehu killed Ahab's son, and then he also killed Ahaziah. So his dad died when Joash was an infant. His grandmother killed his mom and all of his other siblings that he could find, and he was only spared because an individual hid him and then snuck him out of the king's house. Okay, if you look with me back in chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed the seed royal. But Jehoshabeah, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, so this would have been his dad's sister. So what's the relationship here? Aunt or aunt, depending on how you say it. Okay, we're in the south, so it's going to be Aunt Jehoshabeah. Took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons which were slain, and they hid him, even him and his nurse, in the bedchamber from Athaliah, so that he was not slain. He was with her, hid in the house of the Lord 6 years. So he was an infant. 6 years he was in hiding, so Athaliah reigned somewhere between 6 and 7 years. Okay? So here you have part of the story. Now, hold your finger here in Kings and turn over to Chronicles with me. But rather than 2 Chronicles 24, we're going to back up to 2 Chronicles 22, because that's where we get the rest of the puzzle here. 2 Chronicles 22, verse 1. The inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, king in his stead. For the band of men that came with the Arabians to the camp had slain the eldest. So Ahaziah, I looked at the wrong reference here. What am I looking for here? It is, 2 Kings 11, a little further down. All right, that's not it either. Oh, I wrote the reference backward. I wrote 11:22 instead of 22:11. 2 Chronicles 22, verse number 11, that's what I did. All right, but Jehoshabeath, the daughter of the king, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons that were slain, and put him and his nurse in a bedchamber. So Jehoshabeath, the daughter of King Jehoram, now notice the next phrase, the wife of Jehoiada the priest, for she was the sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she slew him not. So his parents died when he was an infant. He was raised by his uncle. But what we find out here is that his aunt, who saved his life, was married to Jehoiada the high priest. Very interesting. It's the providence of God in this. But that is how he was able to be raised in the temple of God. So he lived there for 6 years in the temple of God, just raised, you know, among the children that were there. Now, some of the priests lived there all the time. There was some housing and such. So for people to be around was not uncommon. It would not raise undue attention. And the other thing to note was that Athaliah was the daughter of Jezebel in every way. So she was a fervent worshiper of Baal. So how often did she go to the house of the Lord? Never. Okay? So that was a place that she would never go, that she would never look, that she had no interest in, where Joash could be hidden out. All right? So now that brings us to his reign. And as we've already alluded to here, he began to reign at 7 years old. Now, the reality is he held the title, but there were those around him that were making the decisions, right? The tutors and governors, as the Galatians refers to it in another context. But he had the title of king, but really Jehoiada the priest had a very large influence here in what was going on. So, 2 Kings chapter 12, if you'll look there with me, 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 1. In the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and 40 years reigned he in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, and Jehoash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days wherein Jehoiada the priest instructed him. But the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense in the high places. So other than, one instance there, that's the majority of what we get in the 2 Kings account. Now, in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, told you we'd be bouncing back and forth. 2 Chronicles 24, verse number 1, Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 40 years. Verse 2, Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Verse 3, Jehoiada took for him two wives, and he begat sons and daughters. So we're told in both accounts that he reigned 40 years. It's kind of interesting the way the Jewish historians do it. They give you the end summary up front. He became king and he reigned 40 years. They don't hold that part for the end of the story. He became king and he reigned 40 years. But we see here in 2 Chronicles 24 that his uncle took for him two wives. Now, how old was the king when they took for him two wives? Obviously not when he was 7 years old. I mean, but that's another piece of the puzzle here. There are other instances with good kings like Josiah where they became king pretty young. And, around 16 years old or so, they took a wife for them. I mean, you have children, grandchildren, kids that you know of. How many of them do you think are ready to be married and be parents at 15, 16, 17, 18 years old? Right. Exactly. But again, that was what was happening. Part of what was necessary in their mind was to carry on the line of David and carry on the line of the king's house and so forth. But his uncle, at a certain point, took two wives for him. I mean, picture that. You have a 16-year-old who's the king with two wives. That could be a real recipe for problems, right? Thankfully, Jehoiada was a steadying influence. He was a godly influence. He was a godly advisor. But if you think about this scenario, they had a 16, 18-year-old king with two wives, and somebody else is really pulling the levers. And they were happy to have it because it was better than what they had before. They were in kind of rough shape, right? This was an improvement over the previous administration. Judah wasn't in all that great a shape at this point in time. So what you see here in 2 Chronicles 24, again in verse 2, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. So his uncle, Jehoiada the high priest, had a strong influence on him to serve the Lord. Now, it just makes sense in this capacity. If he's 7 years old, all right, congratulations, Joash, you're the king. Great, I'm the king. What do I do now? Well, go sit over here. Go stand over here. It's time to eat. It's time for you to go to school. I mean, he's still 7 years old. He has no idea what to do. He has not observed. Like Solomon was young when he became king, but he'd grown up, probably 17, 18, 19 years in the house of David and had at least observed how things ran. He became king at 7 years old. He had no idea about anything. So from the very beginning, Joash had to listen to advisors. He was used to doing what he was told. Now, if you've paid attention to kings and rulers, both of Israel and of other nations, you will see there were some that were very strong-minded, independent leaders, and there were others that were very much what I would call passive leaders. If you look at the book of Esther, the king there, who's referred to as Xerxes there in the book of Esther, when Haman brings the problem, he's like, here's the king's ring, do whatever you want. When Esther points out the problem and asks for a solution, he's like, here's the king's ring, do whatever you want. He did not seem to be a man that would think for himself a whole lot, okay? Others would, but what I'm saying is, of necessity, Joash had to be in that situation. All right, here, Mr. King, sir, we need you to sign this. We need your ring. I mean, how old was he before he was allowed to have his own signet ring and seal whatever he wanted to versus Jehoiada keeping it and, in essence, signing his signature for him? Just, you know, unusual circumstances. But I point that out because I think it's important here and important later on in his life. He started out when he was 7 years old. Of necessity, he had to listen to people. We're told here later on in this chapter in 2 Chronicles that Jehoiada lived to be 137 years old. So it's very likely that, you know, Joash was 30 years old when his uncle died, or maybe a little more. But, you know, the point being, he, for most of his life, had leaned on somebody else, right? What do I do now? What do I do here? What do I do there? He'd kind of gotten used to that method of operation. It can be good. He served the Lord all the days of Jehoiada his uncle. And I think he was sincere in this. We also have read the statement here in 2 Kings and in Chronicles that the people still worshipped in the high places. Why was that significant? Why was that a problem? The heathen did it. They weren't devoted to God. What was God's command for his people? No other gods before me. What was God's command about where they were supposed to worship? When God brought them out of Egypt, in all of, you know, all of that stuff that sometimes crosses your eyes in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, God told Moses, when I bring you into the land I'm going to give you, I'm going to designate one place, and you're going to have one house of worship and one altar. Okay? That was a very important point of distinction. And the heathen did worship on the high places and in the groves, and the idolatrous worship did happen like that, but that was to be a point of distinction. There was to be one house of God, one central location for worship. The sacrifices were to be offered in a specific place following God's specific guidelines. So even if they were allegedly worshiping God in the high places, they were still disobeying God's command. And that is a statement that we will notice throughout the history of Israel and Judah. Is either this king tore down the high places, or the people continue to worship in the high places, but that was still a point of obedience, or if I could say it this way, a point of compromise, a point of incomplete obedience to the Lord. So the people still worshiped in the high places. If you're still here in 2 Chronicles 24, look with me at verse number 4 now. And it came to pass after this, Joash was minded to repair the house of the Lord. Why did the house of the Lord need repair? Well, it had been neglected. I'm hearing the name Athaliah mentioned too, and that's a great answer. Okay? Who had preceded Athaliah? Her son Ahaziah, who was not all that spiritual either. So, we don't know exactly at what point this is, but it seems like he was, you know, old enough to be making his own decisions and kind of setting his own mind a little bit. So, I mean, just for argument's sake, let's just say that this is 10 to 15 years after he became king. Okay? So, 6 to 7 years under Athaliah plus another 15 years to this point means 20 years minimum. No maintenance, you know, of any significance, no upkeep. What happens to a house with no maintenance or upkeep for 15 or 20 years? What happens to a church building with no maintenance or upkeep for 10 years? I mean, it's kind of obvious. They had continued to operate, but you understand how that works sometimes in your own house, in churches, in ministries sometimes. Sometimes you see things that you'd like to do, but the funds aren't necessarily there to do everything you want to do. Sometimes you just kind of survive and operate, and you can't do everything you want to do. But here, he wanted to repair the house of God. Now remember, where did he spend the first 6 or 7 years of his life? In the house of God. Okay, this was the place where he had grown up. It was close proximity to the king's palace that Solomon had built. So this was something that was visible to him, is what I'm saying. But he decided he wanted to repair the house of God. Verse number 5, he gathered together the priests and the Levites and said to them, go out into the cities of Judah and gather of all Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year, and see that you hasten the matter. Howbeit, the Levites hastened it not. Okay, so you see, he made the decision that he wanted to repair the house of God, and the Levites hastened it not. I'll read the parallel account in 2 Kings 12. Joash said to the priests, all the money that is dedicated, of the dedicated things is brought to the house of the Lord, even the money of everyone that passeth the account, the money that every man is set at, and all the money that cometh into any man's heart to bring in the house of the Lord. Let the priests take it to them, every man of his acquaintance, and let them repair the breaches of the house, whithersoever any breach be found. But it was so that in the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had not repaired the breaches. Well, there we have a number. Whatever point in time he gave the initial decision, in the 23rd year, it still hadn't been done. So we're talking probably closer to 30 years of a little minimal maintenance. Okay? So you have the decision that he had made. You have the offering of Moses here in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse number 6. The king called for Jehoiada the chief and said unto him, why hast thou not required of the Levites to bring in out of Judah and out of Jerusalem the collection according to the commandment of Moses, the servant of the Lord, and of the congregation of Israel for the tabernacle of witness? For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken up the house of God. Also the dedicated things of the house of the Lord they did bestow upon Baalim. So there's your answer. Under the time of Athaliah, it had been intentionally desecrated and destroyed, and the offerings that should have gone to the house of God had gone to Baal, to the idols. Verse 8, at the king's commandment, they made a chest and set it without the gate of the house of the Lord, and they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to bring to the Lord the collection that Moses, the servant of God, laid upon Israel in the wilderness. So what is the collection in the wilderness, or the offering of Moses? Well, I've given you two references here in the notes. In Exodus 25, Moses was up on the mountain. If you remember, Exodus 20, God spoke to the people, the Ten Commandments. It sounds like God spoke out loud to the people, and they heard the voice of God give what we call the Ten Commandments. Moses went up, and God said, go back down and tell the people to stay away. And so Moses went back down, then Moses went back up the second time. When he went back up the second time, he stayed on the mountain for 40 days. Okay, during that time, he was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and Joshua was partway up the mountain waiting on him. During that time, God gave Moses all kinds of instructions, and this was one of them. In Exodus 25, Moses was on the mountain with God receiving the instruction. Verse 2, speak to the children of Israel, they bring me an offering. Of every man that giveth it willingly with his heart, ye shall take my offering. This is the offering which ye shall take of them, gold, silver, brass, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skin dyed red, badger skin, chitim wood, oil for the light, spices, anointing oil for the sweet incense, onyx stones, stones to be set, and let them make me a sanctuary. So what was the offering? In Exodus, it was an offering to build, which what's referred to here in 2 Chronicles 24 as the tabernacle of witness, to build the tabernacle. In other words, he said, take a free will offering to build the house of God. So in Exodus 25, God told Moses, take an offering. In Exodus 35, we have the account of when Moses actually took the offering, beginning In verse number 4, Moses spake unto the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, This is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. Whosoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it, an offering of the Lord. Gold, silver, brass, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skin dyed red, badger skin, shittim wood, oil for the lights, spices, and the whole list that I just read. If you've studied the tabernacle in detail, you probably recognize some of those ingredients. Because the coverings of the tabernacle was fine twined linen and ram skins dyed red and goat skins and badger skins. And the breastplate for the priests was the stones to be set and gold and silver and brass. All the mercy seat that was the lid for the Ark of the Covenant was made out of a talent of pure gold. And the lampstand was made out of gold. And all the altar of incense and the table of showbread, all those things were overlaid with gold. But I think what's being referred to here is a free will offering. In Exodus, they needed an offering to have the materials to build the tabernacle. In 2 Chronicles, they needed an offering to repair the house of God. Okay, some similarities, not identical. But nonetheless, where did they get the offering that they gave in the wilderness in Exodus 35? Yeah, from Egypt. So in other words, if God commanded Moses to take an offering, God had provided for that offering. When they left Egypt, Moses' instructions was to borrow the wealth of Egypt. The word borrow means to ask for. It's the same word, same root word for the name Samuel, which means asked of God. Because Samuel's mother asked a son of God. So God had provided for it. Then they took an offering, and then these recently freed slaves in the middle of the wilderness built one of the most ornate houses of worship on record. Everything of solid gold and so forth. Well, here you have the offering of Moses. Joash wants to follow the same pattern, a free will offering to repair the house of the Lord. Then we see the delay of the priests. We read in 2 Kings 12 already. 2 Chronicles 24, verse 5, he gathered together the priests and Levites and said, Go out into the cities of Judah and gather all of Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year. Now, that gives us another detail. It's one thing to say, all right, here's an offering basket. If you want to put something in, put it in. Here, in verse number 5, he said, Go out to all the cities and look at people and ask for an offering. I mean, how many of you enjoy cold call sales? Anybody? Maybe a few, but not many. I mean, when I was in the Christian school, when I was younger, we used to have fundraisers for the Christian school and so forth. If it had to do with selling magazines or selling candy bars or selling cookie dough or whatever it was, I didn't even bother getting excited because I knew I was not winning the prize. I did not in any way, shape, or form enjoy those fundraisers. Okay? That door-to-door selling going out, I just did not like it. So there's a part of me that can understand why the priests were reluctant here. Because this was different than saying, okay, we're at the church service, we're going to pass the plates, or the offering box is there, and you know where it is. It's different or to go to somebody face-to-face and say, hey, we're taking an offering because the house of God is really in need of repair. Would you be willing to contribute? To look people in the face and ask that over and over again, or to make a public proclamation, hey, the house of God is in need of repair, and the king has commanded that we would take this offering. Over here is a box, and all of you that are willing to help us make repairs to the house of God, why don't you come and put your contributions here? We'll be here all day. Does that sound like fun? It doesn't sound like fun to me. So there's a part of me that can understand why the priests were maybe reluctant to go and do this. But this was the king's command, right? He said, go do this. They didn't do it, or they delayed to do that. The end of verse number 5 here in 2 Chronicles 24 says, Howbeit the Levites hastened it not. Verse 6, the king called for Jehoiada the chief and said unto him, Why hast thou not required of the Levites to bring in out of Judah and out of Jerusalem the collection according to the commandment of Moses, the servant of the Lord, and of the congregation of Israel for the tabernacle of witness? He asked Jehoiada, why don't you make them do what I told them to do? That's a good question. But, we have at least two former pastors here this morning. Is it fun to ask for a special offering? Is it fun to raise funds for a project? I mean, at a certain point, you begin to feel like, okay, I'm squeezing people too much, or you feel self-conscious about it and that kind of thing. I can understand, you know, kind of both perspectives to a certain degree. Not being real excited about having to do this, the priest not wanting to go out and do it. It was still the king's commandment. There's an interesting statement in this same account in 2 Kings 12. Verse 7, the king Jehoash called Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, "Why repair you not the breaches of the house? Now therefore, receive no more money of your acquaintance, but deliver it for the breaches of the house." Verse 8, the priest consented to receive no more money of the people, neither to repair the breaches of the house. All right, fine, we'll stop taking an offering, but you know, we're not doing these repairs either. That part just doesn't make any sense to me, unless they just hadn't really collected much, so there wasn't much money to work with. The project wasn't going to get off the ground. Okay, so you heard in 2 Chronicles 24, look at verse number 8. At the king's commandment, they made a chest and set it without the gate of the house of the Lord. They made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to bring in to the Lord the collection that Moses, the servant of God, laid on Israel in the wilderness. And all the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought in and cast into the chest until they had made an end. Interesting. So you have the delay of the priests, and then you have what I'm just simply going to call the chest of Joash. He made a special offering box and put it near the entrance to the house of the Lord, and they made a public proclamation what this was for. Now, I personally would not be super excited about having to get up on a regular basis and try to, you know, solicit funds or, you know, request donations and that kind of thing. You never know how the response is going to be. Maybe it's going to be overwhelming. Maybe people are just going to look at you and go, "No, I'm not interested." But the people's response here was very interesting. Verse 10, the princes and all the people hated Joash. Is that what it says? Princes and all the people gave nothing. What does it say there in verse 10? All the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought in. So they were excited about the project. So they responded. They were excited about it. They were glad to participate. And they all brought their offerings until the designated time was over. Verse 11, it came to pass at what time the chest was brought in the king's office by the hand of the Levites. When they saw there was much money, the king's scribe and the high priest's officer came and emptied the chest and took it and carried it to his place again. Thus they did day by day and gathered money in abundance. So they had to empty the offering plate because it was full, if I'm going to use modern day terminology. They had to empty out the offering box, count it, and stow it in the safe, put the offering box back out so people could fill it up some more the next day. I mean, I'd say that's a good response to the offering, wouldn't you? Verse 12, the king and Jehoiada gave it to such as did the work of the service of the house of the Lord. Okay, so the king wanted to do the project. The priests were not behind it, so he just went and spearheaded it himself. The people responded. So now the next phase is to get the work done. You see here the faithful workers, verse 12. The king and Jehoiada gave it to such as did the work of the service of the house of the Lord and hired masons and carpenters to repair the house of the Lord and also such as wrought in iron and brass to mend the house of the Lord. So the workmen wrought and the work was perfected by them and they set the house of God in his state and strengthened it. If we read the parallel account in 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 13, it says, "Howbeit there were not..." verse 14. "They gave that to the workmen and repaired therewith the house of the Lord. Moreover, they reckoned not with the men into whose hand they delivered the money to be bestowed on the workmen, for they dealt faithfully." So the people were honest. You ever needed some work done and started to ask for recommendations? "Hey, do you know anybody that does electrical work that'll be honest with me? You know anybody that works on cars that'll just fix what's wrong and not try to sell me something I don't need?" Yeah. They found some honest contractors. They are out there, apparently. No, I'm kidding. There are plenty of them there. But they found honest workmen who were faithful, and they got it done. So you have the faithful workers. Then in 2 Chronicles 24, verse number 14, "And when they had finished it, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, whereof were made vessels for the house of the Lord, even vessels to minister and to offer withal, spoons and vessels of gold and silver. They offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. Now, I know it's not the most exciting part of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers when all the descriptions are given of everything in the tabernacle or in the temple, but these were important pieces of the puzzle. When there was incense offered, there were certain spoons that they would measure it out with and use. When a portion of the meat offering was, the meat offering being fine flour, not flesh like we would think, the meat offering was flour. When that was burned on the altar with certain sacrifices, there were different vessels. I mean, if you're going to keep the fire going all the time, if you have a wood-burning fireplace, do you just, you know, toss wood in there and that's it? No, I mean, you've got to stir the fire, you got to clean the ashes. And so, I mean, there had to be tools for shoveling out the ash or, you know, working with the wood, moving things around. Altar of incense, same thing. So there were all kinds of bowls, spoons, special utensils, and tools. So they took the love offering, if I could say it that way, they took the offering above and beyond what was needed to hire the workmen and buy the materials. They took the leftover gold and silver, and they made spoons, bowls, utensils to be used with the sacrifices. All right, dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What had they been doing prior to this? Doing like what we would do at home, right? Using whatever you got. So this had all been done up with the tabernacle when Solomon had built the temple. It had been fully furnished. But since that point in time, the house of the Lord has been ransacked. Yes, no. Okay. So now they have to replenish things. So maybe they were loaning things from home. Maybe they had things of iron when it should have been things of gold and silver. Maybe they were just, you know, making do and not able to do everything the right way. But nonetheless, they replenished the work here. So you had the new vessels. So in other words, Jehoiada was not fully behind this particular project, but at this point in time, Joash was motivated to repair the house of the Lord. So at a certain point, he has gotten to that adult stage where he was making some more of his own decisions, if I could say it that way. However, I think the next thing we're going to see is that he didn't go far enough in that. But the following verse here in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 15, Jehoiada waxed old, was full of days when he died. 130 years old was he when he died. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel, both toward God and toward his house. So you have the one major thing about Joash that's recorded in Kings and Chronicles is this big offering that he took and the major project that was accomplished to repair the house of God. But then we see here in 2 Chronicles 24, the death of Jehoiada the priest. This is a turning point. This was a turning point in the life of Joash. But I think at this point, Joash sincerely was wanting to serve the Lord, wanting to do right. And then after the death of Jehoiada, he began to listen to the wrong influences. I point that out just to say that don't assume just because somebody made a bad decision at some point that everything about their life was insincere. I think Joash really did want to serve the Lord and really did accomplish some good things for the Lord, even though when we look at the end of his life, his final testimony was not the greatest. So, you have the daughter of Jezebel as king, and she kills all the king's sons, and then miraculously there's one spared, and yay for us, a 7-year-old is king, a 12-year-old is king, an 18-year-old is king. Did God forget his people? Did God forget his promises? Okay? Did God, you know, abandon his house? No. So, I mean, to me, that gives me hope as we start a new year that the promises of God can be relied upon. Okay? Even sometimes things look great, sometimes things look bleak, and those cycles tend to happen, right? Good news, bad news, you know, favorable things, unfavorable developments. But just remember, as we go into a new year, God hasn't forgotten about his people. God can still accomplish what needs to be done. our responsibility as individuals, as families, as a church, is to serve Him faithfully, do the things that we can, and then trust God to do the other things that are beyond our control. Well, I think we can see those lessons here in the life of Joash. We don't quite have time to finish this this morning, so we'll wrap up the life of Joash next week. Let's bow for prayer and close for this morning. Thank you, Lord.